This is an RNIB Connect radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark important moments in their life. From maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give people hope for a future or maybe inspire them. My guest today is talented blind opera soprano singer Denise Lee, winner of Channel 4's Opportunity Opera Competition, semi-finalist in Britain's Got Talent 2024, who has performed on many stages over the years, including the London Coliseum, and is also a patron of many charities too. Hello Denise, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello Toby, thanks for inviting me.
We're going to start with a great sounding, I think, Northern Soul track, The Night by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, and one that you say, Denise, you have known all of your life, and one that I think you got sort of, I suppose, growing up with your cousins, and they were great fans of Motown and Soul. Would you be able to paint me a picture of, I suppose, a typical day for you at that time of your life?
Well, I was the only girl in a huge family of boys. I was an only child. I am an only child. But I had lots and lots of cousins, and they were all boy cousins and quite a lot older than me because my mum was 10 years younger than her sister. So, you know, there was quite a generation gap. And they were very, very into music. So we all lived very close together in the village I still live in now. And we would visit each other. Well, really, we visited them rather than, you know, theirs was the house that everybody went to. It was the party house. So we would go round there and music would always be playing. And this is just one of the tracks which they must have had on a 45, so on a 7-inch. And I just love this. I love it from the guitar at the beginning. Right, it's so mysterious sounding. It's great. It reminds me very, very much of a Halloween that we spent in 2019. And we went to a farm, you know, one of these open farms in a town called Sanderbatch, which is about 5 miles up the road. And we picked a pumpkin and brought it home and put together a playlist. There was myself and my daughter, Rebecca, my two older boys, Michael and Sam, and then our little boy, mine and Steph's little boy together, who's called Dimitri. And he was nearly 7 at the time. And so he's 15 years younger than his next brother. So we really make a big deal. You know, there's lots of us to make a big fuss of him. And so we carved pumpkins and put together a spooky playlist. And this was my daughter's choice. And I wasn't aware she knew this song. And I just thought, it's funny, isn't it, how music gets passed down in your DNA. I felt like I was winning at mum, at being a mum, because I'd passed this piece of music on to her somehow through osmosis. And she went, oh, mum, I love this song. And I thought, yeah, it's a banger. I feel like my work's done, really.
A bit of great Northern Soul there with The Night by Frankie Valli and The Four Seasons, and good memories as well. We now have a track for your cousin Andy, who sadly passed away in 2013. Yeah. Denise, what memories do you have of Andy? And was he one of those cousins that I'm sure introduced you to Motown and Soul?
No, Andy was the next generation down. So he was one of those cousins' children. So, and unfortunately, Andy and his brother, they had a really turbulent start. They were two of the most premature babies at that point. His brother was born in 1982 and he weighed 1 pound, 8 ounces. He was born at 27 weeks. So he was one of the earliest babies ever to survive and lightest babies ever to survive. So these babies were really precious babies. And then unfortunately, when Andy was 9, his mum died really unexpectedly from a brain hemorrhage. And he was left adrift, really. And I, even though I was only 12 years older than him, I became a stand-in mum for him a little bit, and like a big daft sister. And him and his brother spent a lot of time with myself and my kids. And really, me and Andy, when I had my third child, Sam, because my husband at the time, not Steph, I was married previously, worked away all the time. And so me and Andy really spent all our time with the kids. He was with us all the time. And it was lovely to have him around. It was, you know, because I could never take the place of his mum, but I could talk to him about his mum because I knew his mum so well. And so that was really precious that we could do that. But, you know, it had a really bad psychological impact on Andy, and he never really recovered from the death of his mum at the age of 9. And he took his own life when he was 29. So that was really sad. But some of the happiest times that we spent as a family were me and Andy and the kids, and we'd always have music on. And Andy was, he was gay, and he went through the trauma of having to come out to a family who weren't very accepting of his being gay. And I feel we really clung to music to help him through difficult times. And this was one of the pieces. It's one of those really life-affirming, you know, like, what's it? I Will Survive is the sort of, is the breakup song. It's the song that helps you get over a breakup. This is in a very similar vein. And we used to duet. And so I'd do Barbara and he'd do Donna. And he loved doing my hair. So I would just, you know, I'd wash my hair and then he'd style it for me. And it was probably awful, but he really loved hairdressing. And I'd let him dye it and I'd let him style it and all sorts. And we always had music on full blast whilst we'd got the hairdryer going. And this piece of music just takes me right back there. And I really could do with Andy now for so many reasons. But one of them being that I had cancer in the last 2 years, and the chemo made all my hair drop out. And I thought about Andy a lot through that process. And never more since my hair's grown back in, completely different. It's grown back really thick and very, very curly, which it wasn't before. But I have absolutely no idea what to do with this feral hair. And I wake up every morning and I say, "Where are you, Andrew, when I need you?" And this piece of music just makes me feel like he's here. It just makes me feel joyous. And, you know, although we lost him in really sad circumstances, this takes me back to a time before then. You know, it makes me remember him as this vibrant, flamboyant, tempestuous boy.
A wonderful track there by Barbara Streisand and Donna Summer, and one for fond memories of your cousin Andy and singing with him as well. We now come to a track from Joni Mitchell, which is from her album The Hissing of Summer Lawns, which came out in 1975. Denise, when did you first come across Joni Mitchell's music and lyrics, and what was it like hearing her music for that first time?
I came to her quite late, actually. I think I was going through a marriage breakup, and she writes some very poignant poetry. And, you know, obviously I listened to things like Little Green and, you know, all the love songs that she did and the love poetry. And then I came across this accidentally. I don't even think it's the first track on the album. It's tucked away on an interior track. And I loved how her voice had changed. I mean, it's still recognisably her, but you can really hear that it's a voice that's maturing. And the way that she uses the drums in this particular track. I think she was really fighting to make her own sound. She wanted to get away from this folksy, poppy sound which her record label had wanted her to make. And she'd gathered around her a new band. She wanted to move more into jazz sounds. And she definitely achieved that with this. And it's so right for where her voice was at. It sounds grungy, as does her voice. It's a darker voice. It's a much, much darker voice than you hear in River or Little Green or any of those tracks, where she's very girly. She's definitely a woman in this.
Through jails and gospel pews, through the class on Park and the trash on Vine, through Europe and the deep, deep heart of Dixie Blue, through savage progress cuts the jungle line.
The unmistakable sound of Joni Mitchell there, Denise, and a great track too. We now have a track that I think marks a sort of, I suppose, a feel of those summer days that we've had, which you introduced to your son during one of the sort of hot summer afternoons that we all had, I think, around the COVID pandemic and all those lockdowns that we had at that time. And one that also takes you back to a time when you were six and dancing with your mother before you left to go to boarding school for visually impaired children.
Yeah, it's quite a two-edged sword, this song, because I love it, but it comes from anything that came out of this year, in I think it was 1977, can transport me straight back and give me a knot in my stomach whenever I hear the opening bars to Sir Duke by Stevie Wonder. It just makes my blood run cold. And, you know, it's probably a really good song, but it takes me right back to those anxiety-ridden days when I knew that every day that passed, I was a day closer to having to go to boarding school. And it wasn't, as you can tell, you know, it wasn't something that was relished or that was looked forward to. My parents fought really hard to keep me out of boarding school, went to court, but lost the right to keep me at home. Because there just wasn't any provision in the mainstream then to teach children outside of these special education facilities. And so I went to Lickey Grange, which is gone now. It burned down in, I always say it was the early 80s, but I think it was much later than that. Now it's very desirable flats. It's a song which makes me feel quite anxious in one way, but on the other hand, it's a moment of stillness and happiness, even from that year, which was quite a miserable year. And it makes me feel a sense of loss, but also then it redeemed itself later, because when we were locked down, I was really lucky that one of my sons, Michael, who was 24 at the time, and Sam was 22. So Sam was just finishing his master's at Lancaster University, and Michael was working in hospitality in a pub in the middle of Manchester. And so he had no work, and Sam came home as soon as he heard about lockdown starting. And we spent lots and lots of really, we were in our bubble, you know, the family here. So there was me, Steph, Mike, Sam and Dimitri. And we played a lot of music in the garden, because if you remember that summer, it was a really beautiful, clear summer. It was a good job it was, really, because we could all get outside and enjoy being outside without, you know, without worrying about being too close to people who weren't within our bubble. So we sat in the garden, ate outside a lot, played a lot of music on Bluetooth speakers. And this was one of the pieces which I played, and my sons had never come across, especially Sam, who is an amazing bass player and plays the upright bass as well. So he's an amazing musician. And I always love introducing him to pieces which he's never come across before, because he just enjoys them. You can see him enjoying them. And we are quite competitive about, you know, who knows the best music. So yeah, we were sitting in the garden and I played him this and I couldn't believe he'd never heard it before. And he was bowled over by it because of the harmonies. The harmonies are great. And again, as this song had been a little pocket of happiness during that summer of 1977, it fulfilled the same job, really, in the summer of 2020.
And what is this track, Denise, and why is it so good to be able to share music with your son and the whole of your family?
It's O Lorry by the Alessi brothers. And it's really important to be able to share music with them because they are very, very gifted amateur musicians and really adventurous and eclectic in their music tastes. So I just love being able to, they're lovely. There's something really luxurious about being able to spend time with your grown-up children because they're your children, but they're kind of, they're responsible for themselves. Now you can enjoy them as adults. You can reap the benefit of all the hard work you put in with them when they were six. And I do look at them sometimes and think, yeah, we did a really good job with these kids.
I'd like to stay in love with you all summer and after fall. I'll keep you warm through the winter.
A great sounding track there, and maybe sort of bittersweet memories, but good memories of wonderful days during that hot summer that we had during the pandemic. I am sure that many listeners will remember when you won the Opportunity Channel 4 competition, which I think was probably the catalyst for the starting point for your opera singing career. How did this sort of, I suppose, Opportunity Channel 4 competition come about? And how did you sort of, I suppose, get onto it back then?
I live in a really tight-knit community. It's very musical. We've got a male voice choir and a ladies voice choir, and we've got a brass band. And someone had seen an advert on Channel 4, and I never saw an advert for it, but they had, and this was in the day before you could go online and fill everything in online. It was 2002, the end of 2001, so very, very early this century, when the internet was still quite young, really. And they'd seen an advert for a competition where Channel 4 and English National Opera wanted to do a search for amateur singers who they could train up and put into a production at the Coliseum in London. And this neighbour had thought it would be absolutely perfect for me. So he'd dug out the application forms, printed them off on his printer, and came down to my house and said, fill these in and do it. And I'd got no idea what it was. And I looked at it and I thought, do you know, this looks like it really is right up my street. Because although I'd never worked as a professional before, I was a very, very active amateur singer. And so I'd been involved in brass bands since I was in my early teens or probably a preteen. And I'd been singing operatic arias without even realising that's what I was singing, you know, because they would say, go away and learn this and then come back and sing it for us in a concert in 3 weeks' time, you know. So I'd go off and learn a piece of Puccini or learn a piece of Vivaldi or Handel and then come back and sing it. And I didn't know I needed to be scared of the repertoire at all. And so I wasn't. And this developed a great affinity with opera and with classical song. And it started a love affair, which still goes on now, really. And so when I filled in these forms and I sent off a video of some footage of me performing at Warwick University, doing Mozart's Et incarnatus est from the Mass in C minor, and I sent it off and I thought, well, I'll probably hear no more about it. It was the turn of the year, so it was beginning of January. And I didn't hear anything until the middle of March, and I got a letter saying that they'd been overwhelmed with applications And I'd been distilled down to the last 100. And could I come and audition up at the Royal Northern on the 8th of April? So it had taken a really long time, over 3 months. And yeah, I went. I sang Let the Bright Seraphim from Samson, which of course was made really famous by Kiri Takanawa, who sang it at then Prince of Wales and Lady Diana Spencer's wedding. So, you know, that's where I knew it from, with that feather in her hat bobbing along as she sang. And so I went along and sang it and heard 10 days later that I'd got through to the last 20. So now it started to feel really, really possible. And they then selected pieces for me to sing. So there were ensemble pieces from The Marriage of Figaro, in my case, and, what else was there? And there's a Marriage of Figaro and something else. And I could choose a piece of music. No, they chose me a piece of music, actually. It was from Handel's Julius Caesar, a piece called Piangero, which is one of the Cleopatra arias. Absolutely tailor-made for me. So it was really reassuring that this was a competition run by singers and singing teachers, people who knew about voices, because they'd spotted that I was an early music singer and that's where my passion lay, you know, with Handel and Vivaldi and Purcell. And so the piece they chose me really played into that. And I went and I spent that early May Bank holiday down in London. We went to see an opera, and it was only about the second or third time I'd been to an opera, and it was the first time I'd been to a London opera house. I was overwhelmed, absolutely overwhelmed. And then the night after, I was singing on the stage at the Coliseum, you know, singing my chosen aria, which they'd chosen for me. And the night went on and on and on into the very, very early hours. And the 20 of us sang, and 6 of us were then chosen to go through. And I was one of the 6.
And the next track that you have chosen, Denise, is part of Verdi's Rigoletto. And it was, I think, your debut performance on the stage of English National Opera at the Coliseum. What was it like stepping out onto that stage in your debut performance, and why this particular version of Rigoletto?
Rigoletto, it was the prize from Winning Opportunity. I sang half of the role of Gilda. The other half was sung by Jane Gilchrist, who was also one of the competitors from Opportunity. They always wanted to have 2 of us because singers get sick in the winter. And this was going on all the way through the winter, and we were performing on the 1st of March in the Coliseum. So 2 of us were chosen. She sang the first half of Gilda, the half who falls in love and gets wooed by the Duke. And then I sang the second half, the disillusioned half, the violated and devastated half of Gilda, who's had her dreams broken and her life shattered. And then she decides that there's nothing to live for, and offers herself up as a sacrifice at the end of the opera instead of the Duke being killed. Rigoletto is having his I told you so moment, and Gilda is just having her life destroyed. And she sings this sob of a song, of an aria, and against what everyone else is singing. And it's so perfectly written. You don't need to be able to understand what they're saying to understand that she's dying.
And this particular version of Rigoletto, why this particular version?
I just loved Dmitri Forostovsky. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. He died far too early. And my Dmitri is named for him because I was a massive fangirl.
We'll play it in.
Thank you.
Schiavo son de vezzi tuoi,
part of Verdi's Rigoletto there, and memories of your first performance after winning Channel 4's opportunity and performing for English National Opera on the stage for Colosseum. Now to a track which is for a good friend and colleague of yours, Denise, Chris Channing, who you have been, I suppose, friends with for quite some time and probably since Opportunity. And Chris has been there, I suppose, to help you with some of that sort of physicality and presence that you need when you're on stage or when you're being filmed, like for the Channel 4 competition. And I wondered sort of, I suppose, what do you think you have been able to, I suppose, gain from Chris, and what were the things that you probably were maybe missing as a performer?
I think because I was a performer who didn't see, and I was the blind child of a blind mum as well, my physicality was perhaps just more insular than someone who could see, because, you know, I'd not had that. I had had a lot more sight than I now have, but it definitely wasn't enough to be able to see people in detail and to pick up the sort of finer idiosyncrasies of body language. So when I did Opportunity, I decided I really needed to be certain that what I was doing was an accurate representation, and just to learn about fluidity of movement and accuracy of body language. And I know there are variabilities because everybody's body language is very unique to them, but I didn't want to be misfiring and sending out the wrong signals. And so when I came across Chris, he wrote me a piece of fan mail after Opportunity because he loved the Handelaria from Julius Caesar, which I sang as part of the semi-finals of Opportunity. And he used to dance as a younger man with the Royal Ballet, and he put himself through ballet school. It was a real Billy Elliot story. He was from Preston. He saved and scrimped and scraped and worked and put himself through ballet school and then became a principal dancer. And, of course, the life of a ballet dancer, actually dancing principal roles, isn't that long, because it's very, very, it really damages your joints, and it makes your ankles and your knees really suffer and pay. But Chris had become a mime, and he'd become a performance artist, and he did acts with living paintings. And so he contacted me after Opportunity, and I thought, I can't think of anyone better to work with on body language than somebody who's trained as a mime. You know, someone, because I did a lot of work during Opportunity wearing masks. We were all trained wearing these beautiful leather handcrafted masks. And I found it a really empowering thing to do, because it takes all of the focus out of your face, and it moves the focus of movement much lower in your body. And I found that a really freeing and releasing experience. And I wanted to explore this. So I asked Chris whether he'd be willing to work with me. And he thought it was a fabulous idea, fortunately. So I spent a lot of time going backwards and forwards to Italy, and he'd come over to us, and we'd hire the village hall and spend a whole week just working 8 hours a day, you know, in learning about dance, learning about fluidity, learning about gesture, learning about mime. And it was absolutely indispensable. It's probably been the best thing I've ever done. And whilst we were working together, of course, we talked about music, because it was music which had brought us together. And he introduced me to this singer, Mina, who's, by the time he told me about her, she was more mature. Again, there's a bit of a theme. I love these older voices. I love what happens to a voice as it gets older, and to hear how the voice develops. And this is a cover version of a Beatles track. And I love a good cover version, but only really if it does something different to the original. You know, like when you hear A Little Help From My Friends by Joe Cocker, and it's so different to the original. This is Come Together, which again is another Beatles track. Absolutely, I'm not saying anything about the Beatles originals. They did this originally, and it's a tremendous track. But I love her voice in this, and I love the orchestration. She uses an upright bass as a solo instrument at the beginning, and I just love it. I love how jazzy it is. I love how it's mashed up with Michael Jackson's Thriller. I just love everything about this track. You can't put this on without dancing like a maniac.
I know you.
Mina there, and what I would probably say a fantastic cover version of the Beatles' Come Together. Denise, we now come to your final track, and one that you might maybe like to pass on to others that might give them hope or might just inspire them, that kind of thing. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
It's You Give Me Something by James Morrison. This is a song which reminds me very much of that period in the mid-noughties when I met Stefan. We met in really strange circumstances. Stefan stood in as a pianist for an event I was hosting for the RNIB at the BAFTA buildings in London in January of 2006. And we were scheduled to do two pieces together. And I spoke to him about 10 days before the event and thought he just loved himself a bit, you know? And I said to him, what do you know that I'll know? And he said, oh, I know everything. And I thought, no, you don't. And so I said, shall we do Glitter and Be Gay by Bernstein? Because I knew that there's no way you'd know it. And he went, I'd have to work on that. And I thought, right, okay, I've proved my point now. And so we settled on doing a piece by Puccini, O Mio Babbino Caro. And a piece by Mozart from The Marriage of Figaro, De Vieni. And, I mean, the aside is he played brilliantly. And in the end, he ended up moving back up to the north because he's from Manchester. And he moved back north so that we could work more constantly together. But in the meantime, we sort of accidentally fell in love. I got three children. I'm quite a lot older than Stefan. I'm 12 years older than Stefan. So he was just out of university. And I got three kids and I wasn't looking for a relationship at all. But I think it snuck up on us both, really. And he bought me this album when it was released. It must have been released late spring 2006. And We used to listen to this album constantly. It was on loop. And it seemed to say everything about what we were feeling at the time. We were both a bit nervous about getting involved, you know, because he was living down in London at the time. I was living up here. He was going to relocate up here. It's a big move. And I got three kids. So it is a big gamble, but I'm so glad we took it. We did take the leap, and it's been an amazing adventure. And this reminds me of those very, very early days. And I always think about, you know, James Morrison, who was quite young when he brought this out, and he'd probably been playing this as an acoustic track around small venues for ages. And then suddenly it was arranged a huge instrumentation orchestration for this album with brass and strings and synths and absolutely top-notch musicians. I mean, it makes me want to cry when I hear the track, even leaving out the words and the voice. It's so perfect.
Well, what a great track to end with. You Give Me Something by James Morrison. And thank you so much indeed, Denise Lee, for sharing your tracks of my life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been so hard, but such fun. Thank you for inviting me.
You only stay with me in the morning. You only hold me